Major support for Out to Lunch on WWNO provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with more than 375 attorneys and offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base, JonesWalker.com, and from Iberia Bank, offering comprehensive banking services designed to meet the needs of consumer, small business, and commercial clients, serving Louisiana clients for 128 years, and now serving a regional base with a commitment to developing people and investing in its communities, IberiaBank.com. Additional support comes from Luba Workers' Comp and 30 North Investments.
From Commander's Palace Restaurant in the Garden District in New Orleans, we're out to lunch with Peter Ricchiuti. Peter Ricchiuti is Tulane University's A.B. Freeman School of Business professor and economist. It's business, New Orleans style.
Hi, I'm Peter Ricchiuti. Welcome to Out to Lunch. We know times have changed in New Orleans. A surge of new faces has transformed the city, taking us from 40 straight years of net migration loss to the last few years of annually growing population. Most of us think we can pick out these new immigrants by their hipster beards, tattoos, and bicycles. But stereotyping only works up to a point. My guests today fit the profile of new residents who have a profound effect on the city. But you could easily be standing next to them at Winn-Dixie or Saints game and have no idea who they are. But in their fields, they're superstars. If I listed every achievement on Jay Hake's resume, I'd take up all the time we have. So let me just tell you this by way of introduction. Jay was Director of Research and Policy for President Obama's BP Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill Commission. He was administrator of the nonpartisan U.S. Energy Information Administration during the Clinton administration. He served as director of the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library and Museum in Atlanta, and he began his career teaching political science at the University of New Orleans. Jay Hakes, welcome to Out to Lunch.
Great to be here, Peter.
Rob Lacka is the director of strategy and partnerships at Propeller, a socially conscious startup incubator in New Orleans. He is also a lecturer at Loyola University's College of Business, where he teaches an MBA course on venture capital investing. He is a partner with Medora Ventures, a strategy consulting firm with offices in Louisiana, New York, Massachusetts, and Washington, D.C. Previously, Rob served in Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's Office of Global Partnerships and was on her policy planning staff. As a Presidential Management Fellow in 2010, he co-authored the President's Cross-Sector Partnership Strategy. He was a leading architect of two presidential initiatives, the Global Entrepreneurship Summit and the Young African Leadership Initiative. Woo! Rob Lacka, welcome to Out to Lunch.
So nice to be here.
Now, Jay, let me start with you. Let's kick off with current events. You're just back from Cuba. You were invited to give opening remarks at a conference co-sponsored by the government of Cuba and the International Association of Drilling Contractors. What is that all about? Are we looking at some sort of joint U.S.-Cuba oil exploration?
Well, back when the Oil Spill Commission was doing its work, we were concerned about the entire Gulf region, and we noted that there was deep water drilling going on off Cuba, just about 45 miles from the U.S. border. So they haven't struck it yet, but they're out there actively drilling. So we had suggested that the government sort of communicate quietly, which they did, even before the thaw, and I was involved in some of those discussions. And now with the better relationship, we're talking more about that. And they said in Havana last week that they're ready for U.S. Oil service companies to come down there and bid for work. And our feeling is that that work would be more safe if it was done by experienced American firms. The first offshore wells were drilled off Louisiana in the late 1930s. So we've been
doing this. Yeah.
Yeah, we've been doing this for a while. So discussions were very professional and very cordial. There's a new elite coming into power down there that speaks English very well. They love to see Americans. Americans tip more than most nationalities. So we're contributing to their tourist industry. So it was a very positive development, and I think it's one that could have some positive repercussions for people who do that kind of business around here.
Well, that's all news to me, Jake. Is there a Cuban national oil company?
Yes, it's the Cuban Petroleum Union. And they train most of their own engineers. They don't send them abroad, but they're very capable. And I was very impressed. There's a big problem worldwide about flaring natural gas in countries that don't have an infrastructure. So they built an electric plant right near the coast, and they just have a small pipeline coming from the oil wells, and they generate electricity from it. So they solve a lot of problems with that solution. They're not flaring the gas. They're making the life more pleasant for the people that live around there. And it so happens that the oil drilling is right sort of where their best beaches are. So there's a pretty strong incentive to want to do this right. It's one of those things that's been a little bit beneath the radar. We only mentioned it on page 300 of the oil spill report. But the Cubans recognized the opportunity, and they've been very good about it.
And where they are, is that that's not on the continental shelf. That would be very deep.
It gets real deep offshore very quickly. Right now, we met the Great Wall Drilling Company from China. They're doing is they're drilling straight down and then running a very long horizontal pipe to get to the fairly deep water formation. So that well is not actually out in the water, but it's going after some of that same supply.
That's what we did in California years ago, right?
Right. That's how, if you go back to the early years of how offshore drilling started, and originally, most of the supply was in a mile or so of the coast. Now we're going deeper and deeper, and it's quite an enterprise. One of the things I said down there is you got to grasp the technical capability of this. We did a comparison of the Mars space probe and the Mars offshore platform, and there's more advanced technology involved in that drilling project than there is in the Mars space project. More different kinds of engineering, more sophisticated robotics and everything.
This is opening up my mind. I think of Cuba as it's going to be supplying us with great cigars and infielders, but now it could be oil. This is great. Now, Rob, to say you're overqualified for a career in New Orleans business or politics would be something of an understatement. Like Jay, you've worked at the highest levels of federal government, and you've been involved in multi-million dollar investment funds. Of all the things you could have done in New Orleans, the socially conscious business incubator Propeller would not be one of the highest paying gigs you could get. I'm just assuming this. Why were you attracted to Propeller?
Well, that may be a fair assumption, but I think there's a real difference that can be made through the work that we're doing at Propeller. And what's nice is that I really believe that startup companies are creating the future, and they create the type of future that we want to have. And so if we're going to invest in companies that are going to be making a difference, and that means in all of the areas where we have local assets, water and water management, healthcare, all the education and charter schools that are out there, all of it is an opportunity for us to create new sectors so that we can diversify our economy and, frankly, create more jobs here.
And, when you hear critics in New Orleans, they'll say, well, these are great, but they're small and they don't bring a lot of new employment. And when you glue them all together, is it?
We're getting there.
Yeah.
It's a lot more to be done. But you're right. There's been a huge brain gain that's happened, especially since Katrina. And a lot of those folks are staying. I originally first came down here right after the storm with AmeriCorps, was helping to rebuild. Went off to grad school, was in D.C., as you mentioned, and made my way back. And I was lucky enough to marry a Louisiana girl, which also helps.
That is the greatest economic development the state has.
I think many people agree with you on that.
Rob, I saw this in your course catalog. You have that venture capital course, and you said, this is the great line. I wish I could have something like this. Early stage investing meets Ignatian ideals of faith, truth, justice, and service. Now, I would assume... Is Ignatian, St. Ignatius, is that?
That's it.
So what does that sentence mean?
So it sounds good.
It
What's
does,
it
really?
Actually mean? So there's this whole world called impact investing, social enterprise, impact investing. It's becoming all the rage, especially with people who are far younger than I am, people who are coming up in the millennial generation. They really care about finding ways to sort of fit their values with where they're investing and what products they're choosing to buy, all of that. I don't want to just get caught in buzzwords, though. I think that there's actually something to be said for finding companies that you can choose to purposefully make their impact, the good that they're doing in the world, embedded in the way that they're doing their business. So, for instance, if you're doing an education technology company, and you're building out a way for teachers and students to interact more closely in a way that technology now allows for, that's not just pencil on the page, that's going to help the kids to learn more quickly, but it's also going to help the teacher to get better feedback. And the more, the higher student performance goes, actually the better the business does itself. And so it's actually marrying up both the social purpose and the for-profit money making. And so it's a great way to sort of do well by doing good.
And Jay, one of the things I saw in that the book you wrote, A Declaration of Energy Independence, one of the conflicts you brought up there was the constant conflict between kind of environmental concerns and oil production. You seem to have your arms around that situation a little better than most people. What should we be thinking?
Well, I think whenever you make energy policy or energy decisions, you have to take into account national security, the environment, and the economy, and you shouldn't focus on just one. You know, sometimes the environmental groups are good friends of mine, want to shut everything down, and other people maybe want to drill everywhere. So when I go to the environmental conferences, I say you can't drill nowhere, and when I go to the oil companies, I say you can't drill everywhere.
Oh, what a way to make friends.
but I think if you think about it hard enough, it's not easy, you can sort of overcome these sort of dilemmas or contradictions. For instance, domestic oil drilling is often going to be cleaner than oil drilling, say, in Nigeria from a climate or atmosphere standpoint, because they flare so much natural gas. And
which
we don't.
A valuable resource that we used to flare, right?
Right. Well, Texas and Louisiana have it under control. North Dakota doesn't quite have it under control yet. Nigeria doesn't have it under control. So, you know, domestic oil drilling, if you're going to displace domestic oil with foreign oil, you may actually be harming the environment in some sense. So I sort of argue we should start with the easy stuff, like requiring more efficient automobiles, because I think that benefits us on every respect. And then when we get down to it at the end, I think there will be ways to solve these problems. My favorite way is to tax the use of carbon fuels, which we waste a lot of, and then rebate that all through the Social Security system. So you're actually reducing the cost of labor, which is a good thing. And so it's not just punishing people for using energy. We've run some economic models on that when I was at the Department of Energy, and I think that would be a good economic way of dealing with the environment and energy. And
Rob, what would happen? You lived in D.C. with people jump out the windows at that, or is that seems to make sense here at this table?
Well, I mean, I think this table is where we can actually solve problems.
Oh,
I think
great,
DC is so broken, you know? We shouldn't be going to them to solve our problems.
Oh, no,
you know?
Everybody Commanders.
I mean, to be honest, yeah, exactly. Let's get everyone to Commanders and figure it all out, right?
There's a good point to that because, you know, in Washington in the old days, I go back far enough, it was common after you worked Friday morning, you'd go to a good restaurant, have a few drinks, and the decision makers would get together. I was involved in several of those. And that doesn't happen anymore because everybody has to run back to their state or
That's
run
exactly
back
right.
to their district.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if we could somehow get that social aspect of it back into the calculation, I think we'd be better
and
off.
And this was Republicans and Democrats? That
right.
Were, yeah.
And Congress and the executive branch.
I totally agree with that. I mean, having lived in D.C., it's so polarized, and it has nothing to do with the people themselves who, if you made it actually about people, then there's an opportunity to, you know, care about your family, care about the things that actually matter, not just look at you as, oh, well, you're the enemy, and so nothing you're ever going to do is going to be good.
Now, Rob, what happens, though? Compared to what you're doing now, how is it tied in to what you did with the federal government? Are there links?
So there's one real clear link, which is that each of these sectors that we're working on, whether it's healthcare or energy or education, they're highly regulated industries, right? I mean, any business that's trying to build a company in one of these industries is going to have to figure out, how do I work with government? How can I become not only the entity that's going to be the most successful in my field, but how do I make sure that the government sees me as helping to solve the problems as opposed to pushing back and maybe a part of the problem. And so that's definitely part of any public-private startup company is going, any startup company is going to have to do a public-private approach in order to be able to solve some of these problems.
And Rob, I noticed in one of the press clippings from Propeller and actually from your previous work as well that you find you could make a real impact on a new company. In other words, a new company without the guidance and direction wouldn't be as likely to succeed as one that had it. What do you bring to the table that does that?
You've got it. So I liken this to being bilingual. And so if you're a baby business, you need to learn how to be bilingual. You need to learn how to speak about your business, your English. You need to learn how to speak about your impact, which is maybe Spanish.
Right.
And so if I'm going to go to Cuba today, I don't know any Spanish, and so I would be in trouble. But Jay knows some Spanish, am I right?
My wife does. No, there's more English speakers down there. So.
Well, then good.
So by all means, go.
I can't wait. But so if you're learning that as you're a baby business, even if you're out there to say, I want to make a whole lot of money, the more you can speak to the social impact, the more you're able to attract actually more dollars. You're able to go to the government and say, I'm solving this problem. I can prove to you the number of lives saved or the test scores that are going up or what have you. And it actually translates back. It's just a lot harder to teach adult businesses how to translate back and forth once they're further along the line because, frankly, that's just not part of the way that they do business. And so for us, that social impact matters just as much as their financial impact because it makes them a better business.
Jay, let me ask you a question here. If we were to come back 5 years, and I would like to have you come back 5 years or sooner, how will the energy pie look different than it is now in the U.S.?
Well, we've just gone through such a revolution. You know, when my book came out in 2008, I was calling for more energy independence. And frankly, a lot of people just said that wasn't possible.
Right.
And we've gone from 60% net imports to below 30% net imports. And that comes from massive increases in domestic oil and gas production. Then we're displacing coal with gas. And then
coal sort of looks like it's had it. It's
seen its best days. And then the wind and solar have grown tremendously. And then I think the solar particularly is going to continue. So the big unknown from a business standpoint or a government standpoint is what we call storage, which most people would call batteries. If we can start getting batteries that recharge quicker, weigh less, it has tremendous implications for the automobile. It has tremendous implications for what we can do at home. So I would expect we're going to see continued dominance of natural gas as a fuel for electricity.
Which is good for Louisiana, right?
It's good for Louisiana. And I think we'll see wind and solar growing. And then I think we'll be using much better batteries in about 5 years than we are now. And that's going to make a big difference. It's going to make all the things that we need to do a lot easier.
And what about, you know, you just got back from Cuba with the drop in oil prices, which seems to be raising havoc here in Louisiana, not so much in New Orleans anymore, but Lafayette, Houma, Thibodaux, that area. Is now a good time for Cuba to be doing this, or do they have different sets of economics?
Well, they do have different sets of economics. They are dependent on foreign imports of oil for their electricity sector. They pay about 29 cents a kilowatt hour.
Which is compared to?
Around here might be 10 or 11 cents.
Wow.
So they don't want to be captive of the foreign oil coming in. So they're going to try to displace that with domestic. They might be willing to cut some good terms in a low-priced environment to get that. But it's still iffy. You know, the reserves we have in the Gulf have been explored so much that we kind of know what's out there. It's more speculative off of Cuba. And if the price stays low, that will certainly be somewhat of a deterrent. But there are many moving parts. I mean, the most dynamic part of it is American technology. I mean, a guy named George Mitchell over in Texas, sort of a medium-sized business guy, sort of figured out how to frack with water and some chemicals. And, you know, in this is true. In the 70s, we were actually using nuclear explosions to frack.
Wow, that would get it up.
Colorado. Yes, that's petered off around 1971. But Mitchell figured out how to do it with water, which is not problem-free itself, but it was a brilliant insight. And then the bigger companies come along, add the horizontal drilling. That's the big dynamic out there. But there's so many things going on. I wouldn't expect prices to stay in the $45 to $50 barrel range, but it's a risky business predicting low prices.
And Rob, I'm going to ask you one last question. There's so many things in your background I'd like to talk to you about, but one I saw was particularly interesting to me is you'd worked for the Howard Buffett Foundation. What is that?
I did. So when Warren Buffett started the Giving Pledge and announced that he was giving all of his money away, he gave half his money to the Gates Foundation. and then also money to each of his children.
And so Howard is a son?
Yeah, that's right. It's really an incredible opportunity was to work with them and to help them on public-private partnerships, figuring out how you could use that philanthropic capital. And we worked especially in Ghana to focus on conservation-based agriculture. And so as opposed to tilling up the soil, which actually destroys a lot of the nutrients that are in there, you can mulch it, essentially. And that allows for you to be able to build for the long term and sort of re-enrich the soil. And ultimately, in a place with soil that's so barren because it's been destroyed over you know, eons, you're able to actually re-enrich it and make it something that could be more fruitful.
Jay Hakes, Rob Lacka, commentators and citizens can talk all day about the way New Orleans has changed and is changing, but nothing makes the point louder than you two deciding to live here and contribute to the city. Although, like the rest of us, you've decided to live here because you love the city, and all of us are major beneficiaries of your presence here. Thanks for your faith in New Orleans, and thanks for taking the time to join Men Out to Lunch.
It's been great.
It's been great. Really enjoyed it.
I'm glad you guys got to know each other. You should know each other. My guests on Out to Lunch today have been Jay Hakes, energy expert, political commentator, and author of the book A Declaration of Energy Independence, and Rob Lacka. He's the director of strategy and partnerships over at Propeller. You can find out more about Jay and Rob, and there's a lot more to find out, by following the links on our website, itsneworleans.com. Our show is recorded live over lunch at Commander's Palace in New Orleans. Commander's Palace serves lunch Monday through Friday, jazz brunch on Saturday and Sunday, with live music and dinner 7 nights a week. The producer of our show is Grant Morris. Our technical producer is Eric Merle. The internet savvy Jennifer Brady is our researcher. Mitch Foreman wrote and performs all the music on Out to Lunch. Mitch's new record, Puzzle, is out now. You can find out more about that at mitchellforeman.com. You can get the show as a podcast, you can listen to past shows, and you can keep up with us on all kinds of social media by going to our website, itsneworleans.com. If you want to know what we look like, you can find photos of this show on our website and Facebook page. These photos were taken today by Dion Grayson. Out to Lunch is a production of INO Broadcasting for itsneworleans.com and WWNO 89.9 FM. I'm Peter Ricciuti. Thanks for joining me. I look forward to meeting you again next week around the table here at Commander's Palace for more business New Orleans style on Out to Lunch.
Major support for Out to Lunch on WWNO provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with more than 375 attorneys and offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base, joneswalker.com, and from Iberia Bank, offering comprehensive banking services designed to meet the needs of consumer, small business, and commercial clients, serving Louisiana clients for 128 years, and now serving a regional base with a commitment to developing people and investing in its communities, iberiabank.com. Additional support comes from Luba Workers Comp and 30 North Investments.